Okay, we are going to plunge into our study now of class number 7 in what we're seeing on the cover of the book is the Chronological Study Bible. Chronological Study Bible is what the name suggests, seeing that the Bible books have not all been arranged in chronological order themselves, nor arranged in biblical order chronologically. It can be very difficult to get this general scheme of world history and biblical history when you just pick up the Bible's library of 66 books. So the Chronological Study Bible has taken these 66 books and parceled them out so that you read every word of your Bible, but it's been rearranged into a regular chronological order. We're very early in the study, so we're just going straight through Genesis, which we concluded 2 weeks ago, got into the early chapters of Exodus last week. We'll be picking up on page 83, actually, if you'd open to page 83, with the start of the Exodus itself here in just a minute. Well, what we're going to be doing in all these classes, of course, just speaking for visitor's sake, is trying to just do an overview each Wednesday night of the material that you have already perused. So we've covered pages 84 through 100. If I get the screen changed here, let's see if I can get the screen changed here. There we go. So we covered pages 84 through 100 in the reading this week, and you'll be covering them the next pages, 101 and following. But what we've read this last week is Exodus 12, 37 through 27, 21. Tremendously foundational passages for the Jewish people as they have just left Egypt. They're embarking upon that great Exodus after which the book is named. And the first of Moses' laws are going to be revealed in this passage. It is foundational to the Jews because it establishes not even a moral system and a sacrificial system, but it is also giving them the outline of their feast days, which we're going to spend a little bit of time on right here at the very beginning. And so these 13 chapters give us the start. I guess it would be 16 chapters, isn't it? Whatever that is. At any rate, this is the start of the Jewish people as a group that have a very specific, different from all other peoples, religious and especially sacrificial system with its priesthood and all of that is being delivered by God to these people at this time. Now, if you'll look at the screen here, we'll have a number of slides just at the outset to get oriented again. Now, remembering from actually 2 weeks ago now, at the very end of the book of Genesis, that young Joseph had been sold into slavery up here midway between Jerusalem and the Sea of Galilee in an area called Dothan, a little farther north of Midway, I guess. And he had been sold into captivity into Egypt, down there into a region known as Goshen. So about 450 miles worth of travel to get him in captivity and all the adventures he had, which resulted after much suffering with his becoming the number two man in all of Egypt. Because he had been placed in that position by God, he was able to rescue his family, the whole Jewish nation at that time, the Scythian nation. And so they had been living up here in Canaan. So what we're about to see, of course, is that for the next some 40 years, the Sinai Peninsula is going to be the scene of the events of the book of Exodus, and the location for the revelations in Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy are going to be talking about this. So we've got actually four books that are going to be dealing with that area. If you zoom in just a little bit on this one right here, you'll remember that Moses had grown up in Egypt, amazing circumstances that had brought him to a place of prominence there, but forced to flee, he had left Egypt, come down the land of Midian, and spent another 40 years, very humble circumstances. He'd acquired a wife, he had a couple of sons, but he had been reduced from grandson of the Pharaoh, adopted, to just another shepherd down in what is pretty rough country to this very day. You know, he is experiencing then the full range in both extremes of what it is to be living in those times. It's about 300 miles between these areas, and so he is called by God, leaves Midian, comes back into Egypt, very reluctant, does not want to be this great hero, but, like it or not, that's his lot, and so he is obedient, and he comes back to face up to Pharaoh and to rescue these people. So he makes another journey of about 300 miles, and then, if everybody now, hold your finger here in 82, maybe I shouldn't have taken you there to begin with, but when you turn back, please, to the very back of the Chronological Study Bible, you'll find there's only a handful of maps, just four or five in the very back, and if you'll pull out the second one, that's the one that I've also put up on the screen right here. So it's the second full-size map that you have in the very back of the Bible there. And then, again, I'm going to zoom in just a little bit on this one. But what you'll find there, my own place, is proposed routes for the Exodus. We know they were up here in this general region. We know that they crossed over a Red or Reed Sea. We know that they went down to Sinai. We know that they came up to the borders of Canaan. We know that their faithlessness caused them to fail there. It's going to result in these many years of wandering. And so we know that they were around and around, you know, somewhere. But what do we know about the path they took? You can't hardly go find that trail the way you could, you know, if you were headed up on Spencer's Butte. Okay, it's just not the thing. And so don't be surprised or dismayed when you'll see these so many maps. And down at the bottom, it'll say traditional route, alternate route. And give several suggestions. We have about 3,500 years of history that have passed since these events. And so we just don't know. There aren't remnants that are that old to be able to locate these places or those locations. Yeah, but if you were that proverbial crow, and you're in this general region in Egypt, it's about 200 miles straight line to what we think is Mount Sinai, or at least the general region where the mountain would have been. And then, if you draw another straight line up to Mount Nebo, where Moses, at the end of all these books, at the end of Deuteronomy, will be able to view that promised land, but not to enter it, that's about 250 miles. And what are they going to do in between these two totaling 450-mile journeys? They're going to spend something a little less than 40 years wandering in the wilderness. So they covered a lot of miles. They were not happy miles. They were not comfortable miles. There was nothing enjoyable about this time. They were being punished for much of it. That punishment was pretty serious. And we are just now beginning to read about the miraculous beginnings, the repeated failures and embarrassments, that eventual success of this people coming in to be God's chosen people in God's promised land. So, let me go back one chart there again. So, this is where we're going to be for the next four books. Everything takes place in that general region somewhere. Now, tonight, this will be unusual. I don't usually read such lengthy passages when we're just doing this review. But I think I would like to begin tonight with a fairly lengthy reading from Exodus 12, verse 37, through chapter 13, verse 10. But I'd like to begin with that first paragraph at the bottom right of page 83. So on page 83, turn to the bottom right column. By the way, I want to mention, everybody, in this last week or two, I had two different people tell me out of state, and unbeknownst to us, that they've been listening to these classes online. Thanks to Jerry's work with the website. They too are ordering books, and so we've got people who are following behind us now, you know, buying more books and doing this same study. So kind of gratifying, I guess, you know, to see the interest in this. As I said, this is the fifth time now that I've done this, and I've always been met with, you know, a lot of enthusiasm for just seeing the scriptures in their regular order as they unfolded in history. But the book also has, as you'll see in the lower right-hand corner of page 83, these transitions, a little information by uninspired writers, but scholars, helping to stitch things together for us. So let's start by reading that first paragraph about when the Exodus began. The actual date of the Exodus has been much debated. The two most frequently proposed possibilities are about 200 years apart. The first one is that in the 15th century B.C., during the reign of Thutmose III, who reigned from 1479 to 1425 B.C., that this would be the time frame for the Exodus. The second one is 200 years later in the 13th century under Ramesses II, which would be 1279 to 1213 for him. The 15th century date fits the numbers that are given in 1 Kings 6:1, which we're not going to look at tonight, but it's a direct corollary, which places the Exodus 480 years before Solomon's Temple, which would be about 1446 B.C. A 13th century date, around 1275, seems to better fit other evidence. For example, the building of the city of Ramesses, which was mentioned last week in the very first verse of the book. But it requires understanding the 480 years of 1 Kings, which again we're not going to look at tonight, as a symbolic number. So you always have to be careful about when you take a number and decide it's not literal, but it's symbolic. And so always, there are symbolic numbers in the Bible, but you have to be careful. You're not sure about it. So these are our two main or most eagerly defended ideas. Now, if you'll turn, please, to page 86 and look at the chart at the top of page 86, then, again, they give you the two dates for the Exodus that are most popular. And so, again, you can see that same information laid out in more of a chart form right there. As I've mentioned before in other circumstances, does it matter? No. If the date mattered, God would have told us. We're wrestling with something that can't be resolved for the very simple reason that God didn't resolve it for us. It'd be nice to know. It'd be helpful, perhaps, even just in getting the history again in our heads. But it's not critical. Just don't let anybody suggest that because I can't tell you what date, by the way, we keep time today, that Moses 3,500 or 3,300 years ago left Egypt, that therefore the Bible, is untrustworthy. There's no such thing. And nothing changes. The events certainly took place. I just can't put them on our timekeeping schedule, Can't put it on my calendar. So that doesn't change a thing. So there's the problem. If you resolve it, you can be one of the famous Bible students in history, but until you do, it's not something to lose any sleep over. Now let's begin with the text itself at the top of page 84 at chapter 12, verse 37. Then the children of Israel sojourned from Ramesses to Sukkot. You'll note that a very similar map to the one I showed you earlier is at the bottom of this page. So you can see those cities on that map. About 600,000 men on foot, besides children. You note, of course, the women were not counted at all. A mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt. For it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. That is the New King James translation. Now I want to read that verse 40 again. The sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. How long were the children of Israel in Egypt? Jerry? I've asked Jerry to give you just a brief little overview of something that is, I think, very important to us again as we're thinking about these dates. Jerry understands it better than I do, so I'm going to turn the class over to him for just a minute.
if we have the children of Israel from their entrance into Egypt, and that dates 430 years, as it is so often said, we got a little bit of a problem. This occurred to me about 60 years ago when I was teaching a ladies' Bible class in Old Testament history, and we came across this passage in Exodus 12 and verse 40. If you will turn with me, please, to Galatians, the third chapter, and we'll read just a few verses there. Beginning at verse 15, Galatians 3 and verse 15, Paul wrote, "Brethren, I speak in the manner of men, though it is also only a man's covenant, yet if it is confirmed, no one annuls it or adds to it. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say, and to seeds, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ." Now please notice verse 17 very carefully. "And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later," 430 years after what? After God's promise to Abraham, recorded for us back in Genesis 12 and verse 1 and in subsequent passages. So what Paul is saying is that here is Abraham and God's promise to him, and this will include the lifetime of Isaac and 130 years of Jacob. He's 130 years old when he enters the land of Egypt, and he will live there for 17 years, dies at 147. So if Israel is in Egyptian bondage, sojourning there for 430 years, how are we going to fit this in to that 430 years? It doesn't fit, does it? It just simply doesn't work. Well, let's take a look at the verbiage. At the Exodus 12, and let me read first from the New King James that we are studying in this chronological arrangement. But the text reads, again, New King James, "Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. Now, there's no punctuation in that, and that's proper because there is none in the original text. But those that gave us the Old King James translation do add some punctuation. And I'm going to read it from the King James. "Now, the sojourning of the children of Israel, comma, who dwelt in the land of Egypt, comma, was 430 years. Now, as I read that, did I read that Israel dwelt in Egypt 430 years? No. Let me see if I can illustrate this. And Larry told me I was going to do this about 10 minutes ago, so I said try to pull up an illustration, but let's talk about a man who enlisted in the army. We'll call him G.I. Joe. He enlisted in September or October of 1938. He was stationed in the Philippines, and late in 1941 or early 1942, he became a prisoner of the Japanese, who invaded the Philippines and took them. This man, G.I. Joe, from, let's just say, early 1942, now becomes a Japanese prisoner, and he will remain such in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, a virtual slave labor camp, until the peace is signed, the unconditional surrender of the Japanese to the Allied forces was signed on the deck of the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay in September of 1945. So G.I. Joe, as a consequence, he's discharged when he's liberated from this Japanese camp. He's discharged from the Army, and just for the purposes of illustration, we will say within days after he is set free. So G.I. Joe had an enlistment in the Army of how long? 7 years, 1938 to 1945. So we say G.I. Joe, who was a prisoner of the Japanese, sojourned in a Japanese prison camp. Did I say he was in a prison camp for 7 years? No, I said he was in the Army for 7 years. But this man we're talking about can be identified as the man who was a prisoner of the Japanese from 1942 until 45, 3 years. That's what this text is saying. Just read it very carefully with me. We'll read it without punctuation from the New King James. Now, the sojourn of the children of Israel was in Egypt 430 years. Well, that's not what the text says. Now, the sojourn of the children of Israel, who were these people? They're the people who lived in Egypt, was 430 years. What was 430 years? They're sojourning. From the time God made this promise to Abraham until God brought Israel to Mount Sinai and gave her the law, that's 430 years. But there is not time in this to also put Israel in Egypt 430 years. The math just doesn't click. Okay? You may not agree with that. And I may have left you in a cloud of fog, but something to think about anyway.
Thank you so much.
Be sure I get the right thing here.
Jerry brought this up to me about 2 weeks ago, and what it illustrates for us, and the reason I wanted Jerry to present it himself, is just the problems that we sometimes have with translation. And I think that the biggest objection that people have to the Scriptures, and why so many people just turn away from them, is because they don't spend enough time, you know, realizing that what they think are contradictions, what they think are major problems then that make the book, you know, untrustworthy, may actually be nothing more than where you place a comma, a matter of how you translate a given passage. And so in this particular case, most of the translations have the idea that the 430 years is the time they spent in Egypt. As Jerry is suggesting, that's not going to fit other timelines. It's not a contradiction with the other timelines. It is more likely just a not very accurate translation of the one verse, you know, in Exodus chapter 12, verse 40, as he showed us. So one of the things we'll be seeing a lot of, and I hope you get to in a little bit here again in this class, is to help us to appreciate what the skeptics are so often throwing out as these, you know, completely unsolvable problems, you know, and therefore the Bible is just totally riddled, you know, with contradictions.
not one has ever been found that is actually provable a problem. Even as the one we just talked about, if you work the problem, typically, you know, you can find an answer like how to properly translate the single verse. Okay, but let's continue the reading now with chapter 12 again. We're still on page 84, and now we're going to pick up at verse 41. Came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat it, but every man's servant who is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat it. In one house it shall be eaten. You shall not carry any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it, and he shall be as a native of the land. For no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One law shall be for the native born and for the stranger who dwells among you. Thus all the children of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. And it came to pass on that very same day that the Lord brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt according to their armies. Then, we're in chapter 13 of Exodus, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine. And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month Abib. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. You shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. Now, what do we call that feast? It's Passover and unleavened bread. That feast is one of the great identifying marks of the Jewish people. It is the first of the feasts that God will establish for them, more that follow rapidly throughout Exodus in these next few books. For just a minute, let's take a look at the Jewish calendar. They are going to be ruled by a timekeeping system that they continue to use to this day, which is askew from ours. And this blue circle right here is the line for January 1st. January ends, February, March, April, these go around the 12 months. But, excuse me, you'll note, Nisan here, with only one S, also Abib in the New King James Version, same month. Nisan, or Abib, is the start of the Jewish calendar. And they're just about dead center. So it's almost so that their first month begins dead middle of our March and ends in the middle of our April. In this first month, the Passover, the unleavened bread, and the first fruits, which is coming up, are all going to take place. 50 days after the Passover, in the Sivan, for the Jews, our May-June border, will be the Pentecost, the Feast of 50th. which is what Pentecost means, 50 days after the Passover. And then over here, in their month of Tishri, which is our September, October, there'll be the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Atonement, and the Feast of Trumpets. So when you look at the chart, you can see that they've got, with the one exception of Pentecost, they've got almost a perfectly balanced calendar here. There's three feasts that are in the spring, there are three feasts that are in the fall, and then after the Pentecost, there's that, after the Passover, 50th day, there's that Pentecost. This chart, I realize, is too small print for you to be reading there, but I just found it this afternoon, as a matter of fact. It is the Feast of Jehovah from Leviticus 23, but also dealing, of course, with Exodus 12 we were just talking about. In the bold block there, I'm just going to zoom in on that part of it. The first month, which is known as either Nisan or Abib, is the beginning of the Jewish year. On the 14th day is the Feast of Passover. There's our Exodus 12, verses 1 through 14. Israel is delivered from bondage in Egypt through a sacrificial lamb whose blood is placed upon the doorposts and the lintel. The 15th to 25th first day will be our Feast of Unleavened Bread, a roasted lamb, the unleavened bread, which had given them the strength for their Exodus. And then on the 17th day is coming up the Feast of First Fruits. God receives the first fruits. His satisfaction is the basis of all of Israel's blessings, suggested by the chart. So this first month is a really busy month. And it will, for the rest of these people's lives, for their children's lives, for their grandchildren's lives, and then for maybe 1,400 years, to the time of Christ, and for another 2,000 years after that, though now erroneously, the Jews will be attempting to continue with these feasts, which are emblematic, which are symbolic and figurative feasts, meant to teach them about the coming of a great Messiah who will be their great Passover lamb, whose blood will rescue them from the bondage of sin. A Feast of Unleavened Bread, which has to illustrate for us, of course, taking leaven out, you know, a sense of purity, of a thing that is unpolluted in any sense. Also, of course, just the keeping of God's commandments. And then finally, on the 17th day here, this Feast of First Fruits, in which they are taught, and to this day, by example, you know, we learn as well, what do you owe God? The first and the best of everything you are and everything you have. They're being taught this in a symbolic manner by means of these feasts. And so, here, you know, I selected these verses because you see it concentrated in a small passage, you know, this most significant example that God is setting forth for them and by which they're going to be instructed every year. Now, Passover changes every year, you know, kind of like our Easter would day it falls on, I guess. But in 2015, it was April 3rd through 11. 2016, it's April 22 through 30. 2017, it'll be April 10 through 18. And so they have calculated out, you know, every year, but on a sliding basis like that, it is the first of their year. Now, look at that clock. We've got about 20 minutes, and so I just want to take a little bit of time and go through these next pages with just sort of the barest of the highlights. If you have a question, by all means, you know, ask a question. But I do have another sort of side study that I'd like to get to here for the class edge tonight, so we're going to be going, you know, fairly rapidly. But this is, of course, a story that's so familiar to us that, once again, I think that really don't need to be delving into it. One of these days we'll study Exodus verse by verse. We'll get it into it much more closely. If you're on page 85, you'll notice in the lower right-hand corner there, with the start of chapter 14, comes that very famous what? Crossing of the Red Sea. The scriptures tell us that the water stood up on the right hand and the left. Somehow a great wind was involved in that. That they passed on dry land. That Pharaoh and his army were emboldened to try to cross as well. And God saw to it that they did not. The Israelites here are proving themselves to be surprisingly faithless, even this early in their journeying. If you're on page 86 now, or if you have your Bible and you're looking at Exodus chapter 14 and verse 8, it says, "The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel,
and the children of Israel went out with what in 14:8? Boldness. What have they just seen? Parting of the sea. And what before that? 10 plagues from which they were spared and Egypt had suffered. I guess I'd go out with boldness too if I had just asked my master for gold and silver and they'd showered it upon me, you know, so I can leave for God's promised land to me. But if you're on that same page, 86, and you look down one verse later to verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes. Behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so they were very what? The children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, because there are no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? Oh my goodness, how bad can it get? This, we figure, is about 3 days after the Passover. It's taken them 72 hours or thereabouts to get to their first promise. And they go from boldness to what? Why, you rotten scoundrel, you don't love us or our family, you know, we didn't want to ever come on this journey anyway. Are we there yet? It's pathetic. And it really just gets worse and worse. It is pretty sad. So, as we go page by page, toward the end of chapter 14 now, and at verse 25, God took off the chariot wheels, so they drove with difficulty. The Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And I want to point this out, because most all the movies I've ever seen, I think every movie I've ever seen, when they try to depict this crossing, what do the Israelites do? March through the walls of water, they go to the other side. What does Pharaoh and his army do? Pursue frantically until what? The water comes back in. But what were they saying? Flee! Okay? Now skip down to verse 27. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were what? Fleeing into it. If the Egyptians are fleeing a confrontation with Israel, and Israel is on the far side of the sea, then what direction are the Egyptians headed? They're going home. Okay? So that division had already taken place, and these guys are safe on this side. Pharaoh and his army are beaten feet for home when the water comes back in on them. So the inaccuracies that we see, you know, so often in Hollywood and all of that, you know, continue. But not the Bible's fault. Chapter 15 is the song of Moses, the great song of victory and joy. Their spirits rise again. I'm just going to read two verses from that, but I want you to see on page 88 or in chapter 15 down at verse 14. The people will hear and be afraid, they sang. Sorrow will take hold of the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom will be dismayed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling will take hold of them. All the inhabitants of Canaan will melt away. And I find that word a little interesting. I think we sometimes get the idea that God hadn't given Moses much information. And these poor people, you know, they didn't want to go anyway, they said, but you know, have no idea where they're going. What does that list of trembling nations that they're about to meet suggest to you about what they knew of what was going on? Well, that's a pretty clear picture. Where the land was, these are the nations that surround it, and we know that these nations are going to be confronting, and they're going to be trembling, and so it looks like that they had really a fair amount of information about what it was that was lying ahead of them. Chapter 16 has to do with the manna. If you were to translate the word manna, what does the word manna mean? Means what? Or what is it? So this miraculous bread, like dew upon the ground, they've never seen anything like it. It tastes like breakfast cake with honey on it. And so apparently very tasty. And so they're marveling at it, and it became the new name for what would sustain them for some 40 years. By the time you get to chapter 17, they're grumbling again. They're thirsty this time. They are going to be manifesting this selfishness and this lack of faith throughout all of these years. I just wanted to mention that in chapter 17, if you want to make a note in your Bible there, down at verse 10, which would be the right-hand column on page 90 toward the bottom, in 17:10, so Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. That is the first occurrence of Joshua. We're going to hear about him and his faithfulness and his courage. And of course, the sixth book in the Bible is named after him. So Joshua is going to play a major role once the people finish this journey and come into that promised land. First time that Joshua appears in the pages of Scripture. And he's already something of a right-hand man and warrior to Moses early on in the Exodus. In chapter 18, over on page 91, at the early verses there, chapter 18 and verse 1, Jethro, the priest of Midian, where's Midian and what is Midian? Where Moses spent how many years? 40 years. Across the Gulf of Aqaba there from the Sinai Peninsula. Moses' father-in-law heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, as the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after what? Treated sinner back. We don't know anything about this, but apparently at some point Moses deemed it too dangerous, too difficult, too something, that he had decided that he was going to send his wife and his children back. So if you'll now skip down to verse 6, he had said to Moses, Jethro had, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. So they are now reunited out there in the wilderness. Jethro is casting his lot now with them. But it also illustrates something you will have picked up on, I think, not just from the song of triumph that we saw in chapter 15, but a number of statements we made throughout there. The fame of what had happened in Egypt has what? Oh, it's just gone everywhere. Every nation's talking about this. All the traders, you know, are carrying these stories. And so from the beginning of this nation's exodus, they are recognized as a fearsome force to reckon with. They are God's people. And they are a people then that one has to be really careful about. And it's traveled 300 miles all the way over to Midian, where Jethro says, well, hey, I'm going to bring the wife back and be part of this. Okay, yes, Tom.
With all the destruction that was done to Egypt during the 10 plagues, them being such a huge hub of trade, you can imagine that every nation that came to trade with them would know and could see the desolation that was now Egypt and would be carrying up. For many of them, it would become a, hey, we have an opportunity to sell them goods because they have nothing right now.
That's a great point. I never thought about it in those terms, but they're in the center of the trading universe, at this time. And that list of things devastated the country. And so you're right. They're in hardship now. And so the traders, are eluding everybody, at an opportunity for them. So a great point. Okay, that brings us to chapter 19 on page 92. Now, I did some work on this here a few years back, and it was just surprised. I was doing the reading myself, and like Jerry, mentioned 60 years ago, I had to read this, and it just piqued my interest. Let me ask you, how many times did Moses go up on the mountain? Okay, let me vote for one. I thought somebody would go for two. Okay, I was really quite surprised, and again, it's just a matter of being careful in the reading. But if you'll notice in chapter 19 and verse 3, and again, if you wanted to make a note there, as I've done in my Bible, I just put first trip, Moses' first trip. But 19:3, Moses went up to God. Lord called him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the children of Israel, etc. That's his first trip. Now skip down to 19:7 and 8. So Moses came, that is back down, called for the elders of the people, laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, all the Lord has spoken we will do. So Moses did what? brought back the words of the people to the Lord. Now look at 19:20. In 19:20, the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses where? To the top. That's the third time that he goes up. Moses went up. Now look at 24. Then the Lord said to him, away, get down, and then come up, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So what did Moses have to do? Down the mountain, get Aaron, his brother, and up he goes again. And then this next one, and I don't have time to explain it as I am in trouble for time now, but in this next one, verses 17 and 18 of chapter 20, and I had to do some ancillary work there, but I was able to sort out that it's necessary that this be the fifth trip. All the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. The people saw it, they trembled, stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, you speak with us, we'll hear. Let not God speak with us, lest we die. And there is a fifth trip then that has taken place just before those verses are spoken. Now, let's skip the next couple of pages, which you'll notice in chapter 21, the law concerning servants and violence, animal control laws. Chapter 22 is responsibility for property rights. Moral and ceremonial principles are in there. Chapter 23 is going to deal with the justice and Sabbath and three more annual feasts. We've got, you know, a bunch of laws that are being set forth. But I want to call you back to page 95 about this Code of Hammurabi to make a point about similarities in uninspired history, just world history, all the world, where we can find sometimes strikingly similar statements in uninspired writers and in their countries at the same time, subsequent or previous times also, as the Bible people. So I want to read the last two paragraphs in the colored text at the top of page 95 under the title, The Code of Hammurabi. The second paragraph begins, the format of the Code of Hammurabi shows a similarity with laws in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. Both the Code of Hammurabi and the Covenant Code, found in Exodus 20 through 23, have a series of laws structured in an if-then format. These laws begin with the word if, introducing a description of a potentially criminal situation. Format continues with the word then, offering a description of the penalty. This format or style of law is often called case law. We use that term today, since its format describes particular cases or situations. The if-then format of the Code of Hammurabi appears frequently in the Covenant Code, with and without the word then, Exodus 22:8, 16, 17, etc. Similarities of these two codes and others show there was a widespread legal tradition in the second millennium before Christ. In fact, a number of situations mentioned in the Hammurabi Code are virtually duplicated in the Mosaic Code, often with different penalties. Now, the Code of Hammurabi, apparently written about 1754 B.C. because it was carved on this stone, 7.5 feet tall, to look like an index finger, with a carving at the top that ostensibly is showing us Shamash, the god of justice, in Hammurabi's culture, not in the Jews' culture, handing authority over to Hammurabi. So this great king, he was quite a king, he reigned 42 years, something like that, that's quite a feat. This guy had carved in stone quite a large number of laws about 1754 B.C., or there perhaps 200 years before Moses. And we find very, you know, great similarities there. So people fret and stress about this. You know, Moses was just copying Hammurabi. You know, don't trust Moses. Hammurabi got there before him. You know, all this kind of stuff. But when you see, you know, similarities like this, brethren, and I want to take you through a series of them, because there's going to be quite a few of them we've already seen and quite a few that are coming up, they are no threat or problem to biblical trustworthiness. Again, and quite the opposite. Moses was not a plagiarist. Turn back to page 8, if you will. On page 8, in the Sumerian King List box there at the very bottom, look at the last paragraph on page 8. The Sumerian literary tradition, like the biblical record, contains the account that humankind lived to an advanced age in pre-flood antiquity. Both also agree in general that ages began to decline immediately after the flood until finally modern lifespans were experienced. This shared characteristic of the Sumerian and biblical records lends credibility to the view that both cultures came from the same literary setting or environment. Now, these guys respect the Bible. They're not suggesting this, but a lot of people seize on this. They say, there you go. The Bible's just plagiarizing this stuff. Flood was a myth that the Sumerians had long before, you know, Moses ever wrote. The first thing all this does is to confirm that in disparate cultures that had no contact with each other and separated not only by vast reaches of territory, but also by hundreds of years, are telling the same stories. What does that tell you? Well, these stories may also have disjunction in them too, because when people tell stories, you know, things change. But the biblical record is the accurate record. The variant records are with the other guys. And what this does is confirm the biblical setting that we know God had played, you know, major role in and also caused to be recorded for us. On page 9, the very top of that page, you got the flood through other eyes. Divine destruction of the world by means of a flood is a motif known in cultures from around the world. Most of these stories appear to have had their origin in the biblical account. However, the ancient Near East has numerous myths of the Great Flood, which are separate retellings of the same event. Biblical setting as well as biblical history is being illustrated and confirmed when you have differing accounts, but the same general theme. We're just looking for the accurate account, which has proven to be the scriptural one. On page 87, which was in this week's reading, on page 87, there at the Song of Moses block there at the bottom, look at the last two paragraphs. The language, symbols, and imagery of Israel's song are those commonly used for war deities in the ancient Near East. Israel's enemies, near and far, are terrified. Terror, or fear, was assumed to be a separate substance which went before the deity, defeating enemies even before the god arrived. The people of the victorious deity are established in their proper place, and the winning god is enthroned as ruler over the vanquished deities. Peoples around Israel would understand such phrases familiar to ancient civilization. Thus, they would recognize the victory song of Moses and Miriam as praise for the work of a warrior deity who is mightier than any other deity, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods, from Exodus 15:11. And so, if God moves Moses to compose a song that uses elements and motifs from the society in which they are living, does that make Moses wrong? What does he do? It helps to make a connection so that everybody is understanding what's going on. Is God a warrior God? Sure enough. And who always wins? It's Jehovah every time. Now, turning to page 94, which is also in our reading for tonight. Down at the bottom there, you've got this ox that gored in Exodus 21. Starting the first paragraph, certain laws found in the law of Moses concern subject matter that's treated quite similarly in the laws of other ancient Near Eastern cultures. One example is the law dealing with an ox that gores a human, causing personal injury or death. A goring ox law is not unique to Israel. At least four other ancient Near Eastern traditions had legislation on this issue. But now let's get to the last paragraph on that page. Apparently, Israel shared in a tradition of laws that were common in the ancient Near East. In the case of the goring ox laws, Israel and the old Babylonian culture shared the principle of negligence and liability. Owners who failed to safeguard against potentially dangerous situations were held responsible. This is a confirmation of biblical morality. Now, I'm already out of time, so I'm not going to take you over the actual pages. But on page 95, we just saw the shared morals that Hammurabi's code had. Please notice, whose penalties are the correct ones? Hammurabi's or Moses? Now, they have similar ideas. The penalties are different. We can all recognize a crime. What should we do about the perpetrator? God sets the moral standard. That's the only way to know right and wrong. On page 131, we have a confirmation of the biblical idea of sacrifice. Jews aren't the only people that sacrifice or have scapegoats over on that page for future reading. We have similar ideas to this on page 56, 82, 87, 92, 133, 141. And my point is I've been holding off on doing this little side study because you will meet so many people who, in a display of ignorance, think that the Bible is untrustworthy because you can find similar things in other places and so will reject the Bible. Brethren, what we find in these other places is confirmation that the Bible is the only truly accurate and oldest record we have of God's revelation to mankind. Now, I'm going to take just an extra minute or two. What follows next to the end of our reading this last week was the building of the tabernacle. I've always liked this line sketch because it shows you the camps of the various tribes that were on all four sides of what would be for some 39 years, you know, the center of their movement is the tabernacle and the curtains that were around it. Here in the foreground is an artist's idea of what the various articles there might be, this being, of course, the mercy seat and then the cherubim with the touching wings. Okay? This is a life-size model. I forget the country that it's in now. It might be Jordan, but I'm not sure. Syria or someplace. I forget. But a place you can visit just to give you an idea of what, you know, the scope of it is there. And then I just wanted to end the class with a couple of pictures, artist renditions of how this thing was built. It had a fairly elaborate structure because it had to be carefully designed in order not only to stand up, but also to what? Easily take it back down, pack it up, and move it every time that they had to go. So they've got a cutaway version over there on the right. Here's a clearer and better picture. Those rose charts that I told you about before. Obviously you can see the bookbinding there, but it's a double page deal. It shows a little bit of the encampment again, precisely how the altar and the labor and whatnot were situated. And then a close-up of the priests at work inside the courtyard and in front of the tabernacle itself. And then the cutaway version where you've got these four different kinds of skins that are protecting it from the elements. Okay, and then, you know, cutaway again, different artist rendition of how that tabernacle might have looked. It was beautiful, it was impressive, it was costly, it was extremely artistic, you know, very well constructed, took a great deal of talent to put this together, and then it would be their place of contact with God in a physical sense throughout the entirety of the wilderness wanderings. Okay, let's close in prayer.